On June 14, 1977, 92-year-old J. Emma Crapser was found tied up and suffocated in her Poughkeepsie, New York apartment. Police thought she had walked in on a burglary and rounded up the young guys in nearby Mansion Park, including Lamar and Stanley Smith, and a new guy from Brooklyn who had spent time in juvie, a budding boxer named Dewey Bozella. After being falsely told that Dewey had implicated them, the Smith brothers returned false accusations against Dewey and 15-year-old Wayne Mosley. When police tried to turn the minor on his alleged accomplice, Wayne Mosley refused to lie, and the Smith brothers' word was not enough for a grand jury indictment. 6 years and two eerily similar crimes later, one of which was properly attributed to brothers Donald and Anthony Wise, the DA continued his relentless pursuit of Dewey Bozella for Emmett Crapser's murder, despite compelling evidence to the contrary, including Donald Wise's fingerprint at the scene. Finally, with Lamar Smith and Wayne Mosley in custody for separate crimes, the DA had the leverage he needed to coerce testimony and send Dewey Bozella away for over 26 years. However, the fight in this boxer proved to be just too big, a fight that would one day see the inside of a professional boxing ring. This is Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. That's me, I'm your host. And today I am so excited because we have a guest. We have a lot of firsts today. Our guest is Dewey Bozella, and Dewey is our only guest who speaks, besides English, Arabic and Japanese. He's the only one who has won an ESPY award. He's the only one who won a professional boxing match in his 50s, after he was released from prison after 26 years of wrongful incarceration. Without further ado, let me introduce to you my friend, Dewey Bozella. Dewey, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Dewey, I have to say, and I know you have your own book, and we'll talk about this, but if I was going to write a book about your life, I would probably call it Unbreakable, because you have been through experiences even beyond your wrongful incarceration, that would have broken almost any mere mortal. From the time you were a kid, you experienced extreme hardship. I mean, can you talk about your upbringing in Brooklyn?
It was me and my four older brothers and one sister. As we were growing up, things were pretty good, except for my father. My father was just brutal. At eight years old, my father turned my whole life around, as well as my brothers and my one sister at that particular time. One day, we was in the backyard and we were playing, and I came inside the house and I heard a lot of hollering and screaming. And my father was beating up on my mother. And while he was beating up on my mother, I did the best I could do as a kid. I ran over and grabbed him around the leg. He took me and threw me across the room like I was a piece of trash and continued to beat up on my mother. My mother went to the hospital. Me and my brothers, we went into foster homes and group homes, and things were never the same.
Yeah, I'm sure they weren't. And your mother died, and you witnessed that as an eight-year-old boy. Your father abandoned all six of you and went to live with your half-siblings that you didn't even know you had, one of whom, Tony, became important later on down the line. But first, you and your five full siblings were shuffled between separate foster homes and group homes until you were all finally placed together again a few years later with the Coleman family. Then, after all that, you moved to Queens. You all moved to Queens and spent a good 5 or 6 years together with just at least a shred of normalcy. But in high school, I understand, you started drinking, smoking, hanging out with some not-so-great people, and pretty soon you ended up dropping out and moving upstate just after another tragedy struck.
Yeah. I was 16 years old, and I got into a fight with a guy by the name of Stanley Jackson. When I got into a fight with Stanley Jackson, I got the best of him. He didn't like that. Him and a guy by the name of Barney were driving a bicycle, and they seen my brother at a party at Andrew Jackson High School, and Stanley went and stabbed my brother to death. He stabbed him in the heart and in the back and then murdered my brother. So me, dealing with the cold streets, I wanted to get him. I wanted to get him for what he did to my brother. And because of that, my older brother, Tony, so he said, listen, man, why don't you come up here to upstate New York? You know, I can see where you're going, man. If you stay down here in New York, you're going to wind up, you know, in a bad situation. I said, okay, I'll give it a try. Because my true intent, sir, I wanted to kill him for what he did to my brother. He should have came after me. He shouldn't have came after my brother. So when I moved up to Poughkeepsie, New York, my older brother, he said to me, why don't you go back to school? I said, Tony, don't waste your time. I'm not going back to school. He said, well, you know, do something. If you don't want to do something. So I went and I got involved into a program to where I became a carpenter. And I got a job in Poughkeepsie, New York. Madison Square Park in Poughkeepsie was the hangout for everybody that was supposed to be hip at that particular time. So I just turned 17. I'm hanging out, and everything that I did in New York was in that park. So one time I got into a fight, and I beat the dude. I whipped the dude's butt. And because of me whipping the dude's butt, everybody said, yo, that dude ain't having it. And so that's when I started getting around guys who were supposed to be, you know, thugs and all that stuff.
Coincidentally, you're up there in the area where Floyd Patterson, the heavyweight champion of the world, had recently converted a barn, an old barn in New Paltz, which is nearby, into a center for at-risk youth.
Floyd Patterson, I first met him, it was because of a dare. Guy dared me. He said, man, you always fighting it and all this, man, but you ain't gonna go up no dare, no Floyd Patterson camp. I said, what? So I went up to Floyd Patterson camp on a dare. When I got up there, the first thing I did is, you know, I lied to Floyd. I told Floyd that I had three fights, and I didn't have three fights. I was talking about fights out in the streets. I thought I knew everything. And Floyd put me out there. He put me out with a guy by the name of Danny. Here it is. I'm weighing like close to 190 pounds, you know, and he's a welterweight. And I didn't know who Danny was. So I went out there, and I hit Danny with a lucky punch, and I rocked him. And right behind that, Floyd said, cut loose. He hit me with a body shot. The body shot knocked the mouthpiece out of my mouth. And then hit me with another shot in my chest. And he didn't hit me to the face yet. And I coughed. Ooh, you know, because the wind was knocked out of me. And the bell rang. When the bell rang, I got up out of the ring. I said, oh, hell no. I said, I'm out of here. So Floyd said, what's wrong? I said, nah, I'm all right. Take the gloves off. So he took the gloves. He said, Where you going? I said, I'll be back. Don't worry about it. I'll be back. When I got up out of there, that changed my whole life. Why? Because all he did was him with a body punch and a chest shot. He didn't even go to the head yet. I'm 190 pounds and he's 147 or a little bit more at that particular time. I didn't know at that time he was rated number one in the world. Floyd came up to me and he said, do you know who you just fought? I said, no. He said, he's rated number one in the world, man. I said, oh, shit. And I never, after that day forward, after that experience, took boxing as a joke.
No, that would wake anybody up. And what an introduction it was. But now, just when things, you know, may have been taking a turn for the better as your first exposure to boxing, which became such a huge part of your life and which you excelled at and have been recognized now, finally, all these years later, June 14th, 1977. This is the night when 92-year-old Emma Crapser was brutally murdered in her apartment. She was tied up and suffocated. She had linen stuffed in her mouth and down her throat. And this was a crime that obviously horrified local residents and for which there was a lot of pressure on the authorities to make arrests. And the police came up with a theory. Right. They said that Mrs. Crapser had walked in on a burglary in progress and paid with her life. So they went around and picked up some kids they knew were tough kids or whatever that hung out in the park, Mansion Square Park. And they were well aware of you, Dewey, obviously, because coming up from the city and everything else, they decided they would focus their investigation on the new kid in town, who they knew was a bit of a brawler and a tough kid. And they started by questioning two brothers, Lamar and Stanley Smith. Mm-hmm. And originally, they denied any knowledge of the crime. The interrogators told them, though, that you, Dewey, had identified them as the murderers. But that wasn't true, was it?
No, it was far from the truth. I had no knowledge of the crime. And what made them even say something like that was the beginning of them framing me.
Right. So Lamar Smith told the cops that he saw you and another guy named Wayne Mosley, who was just 15 years old, on Mrs. Crapser's porch trying to break in. So they're just coming up with stories out of thin air. Stanley Smith told police that he saw you, Wayne Mosley, and a third guy together in the park on the day of the murder. And then you and Wayne Mosley were arrested for the burglary and murder. But Mosley was a minor. He was, like I said, he was only 15. So he wasn't going to be able, they weren't going to be able to charge him as an adult. So they wanted to get him to plead guilty, right, and testify to your involvement. But to his great credit, a 15-year-old kid, he refused to do that. And there was no evidence whatsoever linking either of you to the crime other than the word of the Smith brothers. So, and a grand jury, they always say a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. The grand jury refused to indict you. That says a lot, right?
Yeah. You got to remember when they arrested me, I was supposed to only be in hold for 3 days, but they kept me for 28 days to where the judge told the prosecuting district attorney, you got to let him go. And so I was released on what they call a not found bail, which means there was no evidence, nothing pointed to me at all. And for the next 5 and a half, close to 6 years, nothing happened on the case. And then the case was reopened in 1983. Wayne Mosley and Lamar Smith were in downstate correctional facility for crimes that they have committed. And the prosecuting district attorney, he said, listen, I'll make a deal with both of y'all to testify against Dewey Gonzalo. And Wayne, this is what I'll do for you. I'll get all your charges dropped and get you out of jail. Lamar, I'll get you early parole. And both of them agreed. However, because of them being by law what they consider accomplices and saying that they were there at the scene of the crime, they needed another collaborating witness, which was Stanley. But Stanley had no involvement of the crime at all. So that's what made his testimony so pure than the other two. And because Stanley Smith collaborating with his brother, Lamar Smith, that was the beginning of why I got sentenced 20 years to life.
But something happened at your trial that should have certainly placed enough reasonable doubt on the state's case, if not actually completely obliterated and knocked down this ridiculous house of cards. Now, for context, between 1977 and your trial in 1983, there had been two incidents that were eerily similar to Emma Crapser's murder. And I say incidents because a victim in one of them survived to identify Donald and Anthony Wise as the perpetrators. Anthony Wise's girlfriend, Madeline Dixon South, testified at your trial that she witnessed Donald and Anthony Wise heading into Emma Crapser's house and testified to how they said that they had gained entry through a window.
She said that they told me they did the J. Emma Crapser murder. And because of what she said, the Federal Bureau of Investigation went back inside the house and found his fingerprint in the inside window sill.
And what's so completely fucking nuts, Dewey, and just sad, is that despite all of this, the prosecutor was still able to cloud the jurors' minds enough with Wayne Mosley, Lamar and Stanley Smith, and a bunch of other non-evidence bullshit that the jury was somehow able to just gloss over, ignore, whatever you want to call it, Madeline Dixon South's testimony and Donald Wise's fingerprint.
Before I got sentenced, the prosecuting attorney did everything that he wasn't supposed to do. He took evidence and put it inside the jury room when the judge told him not to do it. He did it anyway. All the things that showed that I was innocent, you know, he made sure never made it inside the jury room. That's how bad he wanted me.
So 6 years they spend putting together this false narrative just in order to get a conviction of the guy who they just sort of decided one day, almost picked out of a hat, was going to take the fall for this murder rap, and that was you. How long did the trial take, first of all?
No more than 2 weeks.
So you're a two-week trial. The jury goes out. Did you think, Dewey, that they were going to come back and that the justice would be served and they would see the truth?
At first, yes. In my mind, I didn't see anything that pointed to me. So when they came back with the verdict of guilty, I fell to the floor and started crying. I said, how can you convict me? There was nothing pointed to me, you know? So it took another turn on my life to where I had to, like, you know, I had to become like another person, because now I'm sentenced 20 years to life. And I'm wondering how in the world I'm going to deal with 20 years of life for a crime I didn't commit, you know? I looked at the jury, and the jury, seven men, five women, they all started crying. And I said, it's too late. You convicted me. It's too late.
The Pacers Foundation is a proud supporter of this episode of Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom and of the Last Mile Organization, which provides business and tech training to help incarcerated individuals successfully and permanently re-enter the workforce. The Pacers Foundation is committed to improving the lives of Hoosiers across Indiana, supporting organizations that are dedicated primarily to helping young people and students. For more information on the work of the Pacers Foundation or the Last Mile program, please visit pacersfoundation.org or thelastmile.org.
I was in the nail week, and I watched a guy get stabbed in the eye, and his eyeball came out in front of my face. And I was like, holy shit. After a riot in B Block. Not only that, a guy I knew by the name of Slim, I wasn't even there, like I said, a week. He got murdered. And I was like, what the fuck did I get myself into? How the fuck am I going to deal with this? And so my whole attitude changed. My whole attitude was, don't touch me. Don't put your hands on me. Don't be around me. I'm not trying to get cut. I'm not trying to get stabbed. I'm not going to let nobody hurt me. And from this day forward, I don't give a damn who you are. If you try to hurt me, I'm going to do what I got to do to survive. And that was my attitude. And I lived like that for over 26 and a half years.
Whoa, I mean, that's a hell of a first week in a place that could just as easily be called hell. And you were at New York's infamous Sing Sing Correctional Facility, where you needed to be hard to survive, but you also underwent a really incredible transformation while inside.
What happened with me when I was inside Sing Sing State Penitentiary, one day I come from the yard and I was finished working out, and a guy by the name of Sharif walked up to me and he said that I was fronting. And fronting inside the state penitentiary almost is like a call out, you know, like, you know, you're a punk, all these other things that go along with it. But he didn't mean it like that. You know, I took it the wrong way and I said, yo, what's going on? You know, he said, nah, man, I just need to talk to you. I need to build with you. I said, okay. So the correction officer said, lock in. And I said, man, fuck you. You know, he said, you keep locked. Keep locked me, and I'm inside myself for 23 hours with 1 hour rec. So I'm in there 24 hours a day. And it was just this one keep like that turned my whole life around. Because I asked the guy who was supposed to have been my friend for a cigarette. He said he didn't have it. And I said, man, there it is right there in your pocket, man. Why are you acting like that with me, man? You know how I am, man. You know what kind of person I am, man. So he reached inside his pocket, and the way he gave it to me, I didn't like it at all. But I took it because I needed it. And when I took the cigarette, my whole life changed. That was my metamorphosis. That was the beginning. I wasn't even in Sing Sing no more than a year and a half at the most. And I looked at the cigarette, and I looked at my life. And I said, look at you, man. Just fucking look at you. You became the fucking savage that they were talking about. You became exactly the person they were fucking talking about. You got wine underneath your bed. You got reef on top of your fucking goddamn bunk. What is wrong with you, man? At least out in the streets, you were trying to go to school. You ain't doing shit in here. You're doing absolutely nothing with your life, man. Let's look at you. And then I asked myself one question. And I said, if they was to let you go right now, what would your life be like? And I ain't like the answer. The answer was, I would be a bum. And so, I just turned my life around. I just said, damn, man, you know, you lost your mother. Your father don't, and this family don't give a shit about you. You don't know where none of your brothers and your sisters is at. What are you going to do, man? I took the reef I had and I gave it away. The people thought I fucking flipped. They thought I bugged out. I took the wine underneath my bed. I started giving it away. I mean, you all right? You all right? I mean, you want it? If you don't want it, I'll dump it in the fucking toilet bowl. From that day forward, I just never looked back. That was back in 1985, September 27th. I started hanging out with Sharif. And from that day forward, I got involved in every different program you could think about. I got 52 certificates. I got my bachelor's done my master's degree after 26 and a half years behind the prison walls.
It's pretty incredible transformation. And Dewey, I'm going to talk about you in the third person. Dewey also became the boxing champion at Sing Sing. And he became such a legendary fighter in there that they brought in a guy who went on to become the WBA champion of the world to fight him.
If he didn't come out, I was going to win, man. I had cracked his ribs, man, the second round. He was a tough son of a gun. Lula Valley was a guy, man, that I had the utmost respect for. I'm glad that he went on ahead and won the championship fight. What it was like was an experience to make me really, truly understand that the potential was there. The understanding of what I could have done with my life if I chose to take a deal later on down the line, I could have done that.
Finally, in 1990, you were granted a new trial on the grounds that the prosecutor had used his peremptory challenges, which is, for those people who may be new to the show, the prosecutor is allowed to exclude certain jurors off for no reason, just because he wants to exclude them from serving on the jury. And he had used these challenges to systematically remove all black jurors, ending up with a all-white jury, hardly a jury of your peers. So you were granted a new trial. And they came to you and offered you a deal to plead guilty to manslaughter for 7 of 14. You'd already done 6.5, but that was not even a consideration for you, was it?
Hell no. First and foremost, during my first trial, Stanley Smith got up on the stand and testified against me. I think that was what really got me convicted. You got to remember, he was helping his brother. And he told the judge, I want you to not commit perjury. I testified against this man because I wanted to get my brother out of jail. Now that I got my brother out of jail, I want you to know that I committed perjury. And he said the same thing in my second trial in 1990. You know, I still got prosecuted. This trial was so bad that nothing, absolutely not one single shred of evidence pointed to me. To where the judge told the prosecutor, the attorney, he said, listen, the jury should be back in 1 hour with a not guilty verdict. That's when a prosecutor's attorney said, listen, Mr. Mozzella, we'll give you 7 to 14 for manslaughter. All you got to do is mention the nature of the crime. You see the boy in 6 months with the possibility of going home. I said, no. Okay, Mr. Mozzella, they came back with a second deal. We give you what we call time served. All you got to do is mention the nature of the crime. You go back to Sing Sing and you'll be released to go home. I said, no. So then, as the jury was about to come back with the verdict, the prosecutor's attorney, he said, listen, we'll give what we call a scenario alpha plea. All you got to do is just sign a piece of paper and walk out the courtroom right now. I said, no. Jury walks in. I get reset to 20 years to life.
I mean, wrongfully convicted twice.
Yes.
With no evidence. And we didn't mention this before, but the fact is, in a crime like this, a violent crime that involves up close contact, right? It's not a shooting from across the street or across the room, even. This is a woman who was brutally suffocated. There were so many pieces of evidence collected at the crime scene. I heard even close to 100 pieces of evidence, and none of them matched you. There was nobody even ever claimed that your fingerprints or your blood or your hair or your saliva or anything was at the crime scene. And they managed to convict you twice. Based on the evidence of incentivized witnesses, this shit goes on in courtrooms across the country all the damn time. And it happened to Dewey Bozzella, and that's what we're here talking about now. So back to prison you go.
When I got back to Sing Sing State Penitentiary, the following day, I went down to what they call the chapel area. I was trying to find some peace. When I walked in, guess who I see? I see the guy who murdered my brother, Stanley Jackson. I said, oh, hell no, you got to be kidding me, man. I went inside my cell for 3 days and I thought everything out. I said, you took a turn into the violence. You took behavior awareness. You took all these classes dealing with violence. Now in a time of adversity, can you really live this out? Can you really, you know, deal with this? Because Code of the Street said, kill him. You got to kill him. You got to bust him in the head. You got to stab him. You got to whip his ass. You got to do something, man. Otherwise, you're a coward. You're a punk. You're a sissy, and everything else that go along with it. So I had to deal with all these things in my mind. So after 3 days, I come up out of my cell, and there's Stanley on the flats in A Block. And people are looking. So you got three tiers. People are looking down, and the people are looking down like, oh, shit. All hell about to break loose. Now, you got to remember, I was in the New York Daily News Centerfold for boxing, and people know I'm the champ. And Sing Sing, they know I'm not a punk. And a lot of them know that this is the guy who murdered my brother. So I walked to him and I said, yo, man, can I talk to you for a minute? He said, yeah. So we go around the corner. And yo, man, why are you murdering my brother? He said, man, I was young. It was something that just happened. I looked him dead in the face and I looked him up and down. First thing that came to my mind was, man, let this shit go, man. Move on with your life. And I reached over and I shook his hand. I said, yo, man, I forgive you. My man went off. Yo, man, but he murdered your brother. You ain't going to do shit. And he wanted to attack me. I said, yo, man, back up. Yo, man, but. I said, yo, man, you ain't got nothing to do with this, man. It's between me, him, and God. But he murdered. I said, yo, like I said, you ain't got nothing to do with this. Let it go. So when I did that, the word got out in the penitentiary. Yo, man, I don't know if I could have did what you did. I said, that's. Doesn't matter what the fuck you think. What matters is what between me, him, and God, man. That's what I wanted to do. How the fuck am I going to ask anybody to forgive me if I can't learn how to forgive him? How am I going to ask anybody to let my life move forward if I can't let his life move forward? It begins with me. So I make the final decision. This is my decision, not your decision. And I don't give a damn about the cold of the streets. And I damn sure don't give a damn about the fucking cold dealing with the penitentiary, because this is shit that got me in there anyway. This cold shit. I'm done with it. And that was my attitude.
Yeah, it was a code of a penitentiary that you didn't belong in the first place. And somehow or other, you transcended the environment and really lifted yourself up out of those walls, even while you were still behind those walls. And that's incredible. And then it's almost as if you were rewarded, right? Because, and well, in so many ways, because now we come to the point where you're in the visiting room one day and there's a beautiful young woman named Trina Boone who's there. And how did this interaction take place? Because I've been there. I don't know how the hell you could even, you know. Well,
I was like a role model in Sing Sing. I was involved with what they call the JCs. And me being involved in the JCs, I was there for about a couple of years, to where they allowed me to go down to their visiting room and take pictures. And her brother came up and he introduced me. He said, hey, this is so-and-so-and-so-and-so. He's a boxer, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and he's a good guy. So after that, we started talking, and she liked boxing. One thing led to another. I was straight up with her. I didn't pull no punches. I said, oh, I'm looking for a wife. You know, I'm not looking for somebody who just want to be a friend. If there's a chance, you know, if you want to talk to me, you know, that'd be cool. If you don't, it's okay. You know, and I asked her brother, can I get her phone number? And he gave it to me and I made the phone call. He was a little mad at him, but I made the phone call and then, you know, that's how it all got started.
And sure enough, you ended up, well, finding exactly what you were looking for, which was a wife, and she became a huge part of your life and a big supporter of yours, so much a part of the beautiful documentary that I watched. ESPN Films, 26 Years, the Dewey Bozella Story. She is obviously almost like she has a big role in it. Let's just say that.
Yes, sir.
So now things are going to take another few twists and turns. How did you first learn about the Innocence Project? I know you started writing, and it took I used to write the same letter every day from what I read. Is that true?
Yes. While I was up in the Lowell Library still fighting my case, I wrote to them. I said, I got blood samples and hair samples. And I didn't hear no answer. And then I wrote them every freaking week until I received an answer. A guy by the name of Lee said, listen, don't write us no more. We're going to put you on the list. Right behind that, in the year 2003, I went to my first parole board. And I got hit with 2 years.
And from what I understand, the parole board came back at you over and over again with 2 year extensions, despite your impressive transformation. Meanwhile, the Innocence Project took your case in 2005, but when they found out that the Poughkeepsie Police Department had destroyed all the biological evidence, they passed your case on to Wilmer Cutler Hale, who took the case pro bono, and upon your request, they looked into the arresting officer, a lieutenant named Arthur Regula.
Something inside me told me to tell him, go see Lieutenant Arthur Regula, the one that arrested me in 1977. No one wants to believe me. He told me when I was a kid, man, he was going to get me. Go by and see him, man. He might have a change of heart. That's the only thing that came to my head. So they asked him a question. Do you have any recollection about Mr. Dewey Bozella case? Yes, I do. Would you mind telling us? He said, I want you to know that I kept Mr. Bozella's personal files at my house for the last 19 years. Are you supposed to keep any case at your house? He said, no. When I retired, I took his files home with me, and I had them for the last 19 years because I always knew that one day someone would come talk to me about this man case. I believe that he was innocent. Here are his files. Inside the files are what they call Vazarian material, Brady material, newly discovered evidence. 4 pieces of evidence that said that I did not commit the murder. One of the witnesses that said that they heard the garage from our house, the back of the house where they heard the garbage cans being moved by the window sill, where the Wise brothers had supposed to have went in, where his fingerprints were found. And 2 ladies who said, listen, we were sitting outside and we know Wayne Mosley and the other guys who said they were in front of the house, they were not there because we were sitting out there from 7 o'clock to 11 o'clock that night. There was a taste statement that was made that said, I did not commit the murder. So a lot of things started pointing to a different direction. And so all this was brought before the judge. Judge said, this is overwhelming evidence. And if we'd have had this in 1983 or in 1990, I believe that Mr. Bozella would not have been convicted. The district attorney had dismissed the case right there on the spot, October 29, 2009.
So, Dewey, tell us what you were doing when you first got out and how you got the Arthur Ashe Courage Award at the ESPYs in 2011 and eventually got your shot. I'm getting the chills as I say this, as a professional boxer.
I came out, I was 50 years old, and I was going doing volunteer work at Ray Rivera's gym. I was working with the kids. I was also working at 290 Broadway on Main Street in Newburgh, New York. I was transferring people who came from the penitentiary all the way in Peekskill to see their parole officers and stuff like that. So I was, you know, still communicating with the people who was in the inside. And then one day, I didn't know anything about the Arthur Ashe Courage Award. I don't know how it happened. People said that they had recommended me and that I was going to receive the award. I wasn't excited because I didn't know anything really about the Arthur Ashe Courage Award. I get all the way out to LA and I started seeing, I said, holy shit, this is way bigger than what I thought it was. So I get out here. I didn't know I was going to be in front of like 5 to 7 million people. I thought it would be 7,000 or something like that. So I gave a speech. After I gave a speech, next thing I know, Oscar De La Hoya heard about it.
Right. So then Bernard Hopkins and Oscar De La Hoya took an interest in you and supported you in training. But in order to fight professionally, you had to take a number of grueling physical tests to be cleared for fighting. And those wouldn't be easy for anyone at any age, but at 50 or 51, that's a big challenge. But as I saw, as everyone who saw the movie knows, you worked your ass off to get into fighting shape.
Bernard Hopkins, he said, bring him over to my camp. Bring him up to Philly. Then I'm going to work with Danny. And also get him a conditioning coach. Rick was the guy who actually would get up and train with me and work with me and run with me, you know. And Danny, he did pad work and everything to get me in good shape.
And now comes the fight, right? This was, I mean, this was.
Yeah, the fight, the, was, fight, the fight is funny, man.
What the hell is funny about it? I mean,
it was just that I know my qualifications. And he had 4 pro fights, and then he had 12 mixed martial arts fights as a pro. So that's 15 pro fights to my none. And I said, man, I'm taking this fight. I don't give a damn what he got. He wanted to win so bad, he didn't care how old I was. He wanted to whip my butt. And so the first round, he won. After he won the first round, the first thing I said to myself was, Dewey, what the hell are you doing? You're a stick and move fighter. Do what you do best, man. So I won by unanimous decision. That's when I said, okay, Dewey, this is it. Call it quits. I was off for 2 other fights, and I said, nah, I'm done. I said, I'm not trying to get hurt. You know, I proved to myself, you know, the quality was there. Everything I needed to know was right there. I'm satisfied. I'm good. And I never went back.
So your life hit you with some of the hardest punches that anyone has ever been hit with. Losing your mother, abandoned by your father, losing 3 brothers, spending 26 years in one of the toughest prisons in the country or maybe even the world. And still, you remain unbroken and undefeated. And for our audience, if you want to learn more, you can with Dewey's book as well as the ESPN film. Both of them will be linked in the bio. But Dewey, your story isn't over yet. I heard you're living down in Atlanta, Georgia now.
What I'm doing right now, I'm down in Atlanta, Georgia. I do juvenile detention centers. I'm going around and I'm doing volunteer work. Get around and let people know, you know, that, you know, you can turn your life around if you just make the right decision. Don't let nobody tell you what you can't do. You hold the key to your own life. You know, you make the final decision. You know, people may say what they want to say, you know, but at the end of the day, as long as you can go to your bed and you can wake up in the morning and say, man, this is what I'm going to do and mean it from the heart, you good.
So you've been listening to the story and the voice of the man himself, Dewey Bozella. And Dewey, this is the part of the show where I turn my microphone off, kick back in my chair and close my eyes and just listen as you share your final thoughts for closing arguments.
The night before the fight, President Barack Obama gave me a call. He said, hello, how you doing, Mr. Bozella? I said, yeah, good president. I said, wow. Then he said, how you doing? I said, I'm doing pretty good, man. I'm feeling pretty good. He said, I heard a lot about you. I heard that, you know, you're doing a lot of things, you know, giving back to the community and everything. He said, I just want to wish you well on your fight. I said, yeah, man, I appreciate that a whole lot. Then he said, are you sure this is going to be your first and your last fight? I said, yes. Then after that, when he hung up, I had tears in my eyes. And I said, wow, this is bigger than me. I said, because this is the man that wanted to be a basketball player. He wound up being the president of the United States. And I said, everybody who gave up, you know, who actually just like life don't mean nothing to him no more, or just lost hope, or just like, I don't care, you know. I said, this fight is for them. It's not only for me. This fight is to let them know, don't give up. Don't let nobody tell you what you can't do. Don't give up on yourself. Don't make yourself feel like, you know, you're not worthy. This is the fight that I'm fighting. I'm not fighting just a normal fight no more. I'm fighting for the people, man, who actually just like said, I don't care. F it. You know, I don't want them to feel that way. I hope that I can be that sponsor to let them see that you can make it. If I can do it, you can do it. I'm 52 years old. This guy is 30 years old. You know, if I can do it at this age, what excuse do you have? You know, especially if you're young, don't let nobody tell you what you can't do. And that was my mission after that. So I didn't, that's the reason why I was laughing. You know, I didn't care, you know, about the fight. You can't do nothing with me. You can't break me. You can't hurt me. I already went through all the difficulties. I already been hurt. I already been let down. I already know what it's like to have everything taken from you. I already know what it's like to have people turn their back on you. I already know what it's like to have people just like to give up. And there's nobody there and you feel all alone and you by yourself. I know what it's like, man, to just like, you know, just go through all the difficulties, you know, and not once, not twice, but three times, you know, and then have all the hurt and the pain and the deaths, you know, put right in front of your face, you know, and then to go out there and do what I did, you can't break me, man. And that's what I wanted. That's the message I wanted to give. Don't give up on yourself. Don't feel like, man, there's nothing left in life, because as long as you're alive, each day that you're alive, God has something special for you. And if you don't believe in God, whatever it is that you believe in, you know, there's something special for you, because you're not done yet. It's just your choice, your decision. You have a decision. I made all the right choices after I made all the bad choices. And that's what this was about.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Please support your local innocence projects and go to the link in our bio to see how you can help. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Wardis. The music on the show, as always, is by three-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.